dedicated to the survival of American democracy in an increasingly dangerous world, this is Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney, acted as Assistant Secretary of Defense for International Security Policy under President Ronald Reagan, founder of the Center for Security Policy in Washington, D.C., the go-to man for defense and foreign policy issues, joined by the greatest minds in the security policy business, the special forces in the War of Ideas at Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney.
Welcome to Secure Freedom Radio. This is Frank Gaffney, your host and guide for what I think of as an intelligence briefing on the war for the free world. We sometimes talk on this program about one of the most important of those fronts, namely the home front. And in that home front, there are clearly a variety of challenges. There are enemies foreign who are operating here. There are enemies domestic who are operating here. And then there's a whole cast of characters who are not technically the enemy, and yet they are providing an incalculable service, to my way of thinking, for our enemies. Top of that list, I have learned from hard experience, is the Southern Poverty Law Center, or SPLC. It has been around for quite some time. It has become fabulously wealthy, and it has, in the past decade or so, become an instrument of political warfare, in my estimation and in my own experience. A man who has studied it closely and written a very thoughtful and, I think, very timely book about the Southern Poverty Law Center, The Good, the Bad, and the Very Ugly, is Tyler O'Neill, who I'm very pleased to say is here with me in studio. Thank our producer, Maya Carlin, for making that possible. He is the author of Making Hate Pay, The Corruption of the Southern Poverty Law Center. Tyler is an accomplished journalist and essayist. He has written for such publications as the Christian Post, National Review, the Washington Free Beacon, and these days he is the senior editor for PJ Media. He has graciously given us a full hour of his time to really drill down on what the SPLC is up to and why it is so consequential and what we must think and, well, do, I think, to minimize the damage that it is doing to a lot of good people and worthy causes. Tyler O'Neill, thank you so much for joining us and for this important book and for the chance to visit with you at length about it.
Yeah, my pleasure, Frank. Great to be here.
You have studied the history, not just the present or recent past of the SPLC. Give us a bit of a flavor of how it came into being, for what purpose, and what it did, initially at least, that might be described as good work.
Yeah, so the Southern Poverty Law Center has been around since 1971, and it was founded as a civil rights organization, and actually started focusing on helping poor people in the South, as its name is. Nowadays, it rakes in cash by exaggerating hate and is a thoroughly corrupt organization. But it wasn't always that way. In its early years, it helped change the redistricting in Alabama to get the first black representatives elected since Reconstruction. And it got a bunch of people who had been falsely accused and falsely convicted of things like rape off of death row. So it represented the little guy and actually did important work that I think we can mostly agree is good.
And also, famously, was involved in trying to put the Ku Klux Klan out of business, no?
Yes. So that is why the Southern Poverty Law Center is well-known today and why it's so well-respected. They went after the Klan over and over and over again in lawsuits, bankrupting the Klan and similar organizations. But the ironic thing is they weren't founded for that purpose, and the entire legal team actually quit en masse in 1986 because they thought the SPLC had left its original noble mission and gone off on this KKK tangent that was very lucrative for Morris Dees, the expert salesman that he was. And
lucrative in the sense that he could go through direct mail I guess, primarily to little old ladies, I like to think, all across the country, and warned that the KKK was this monster that was going to be tearing our country apart, and but for the SPLC standing in the gap, you know, all kinds of bad things would happen. Is that pretty much the way this worked?
Exactly. He wove these narratives of fighting grand dragons when he was really ripping apart paper tigers. And one of the best cases that I cover in the book was that of Joan Little, whose son was lynched. And Morris Dees and the SPLC...
By the KKK?
By a KKK-like group, a splinter group. And Morris Dees sued them in court and bankrupted them. And he got this, you know, multi-million dollar settlement. Well, the group couldn't pay up. It was a tiny organization. They could barely afford the lawyers that they had in court. And they paid $50,000, which was all that they had, to this bereaved widow. Meanwhile, the SPLC went to its donors and said, "We're defeating the KKK. They raised millions of dollars." So the SPLC is getting rich.
None of which she saw, needless to say.
Exactly. Oh, it gets worse. She didn't see the money. She saw the $50,000 that was all the organization could give, which she used to pay off a loan from the Southern Poverty Law Center.
Oh, no.
And the Southern Poverty Law Center raked in cash, and then Morris Dees got a movie deal out of it. At the same time, Joan Little was trying to get a movie deal, and the producers for Joan Little's movie said they couldn't make any headway because nobody wanted to compete with Morris Dees.
Got it. So Morris Dees was one of the co-founders, as I recall, of this organization. He was, as you say, a very accomplished marketeer, specifically direct marketing, as they call it, through direct mail. Describe how this evolved over time, Tyler O'Neill, into a hustle and an enormous source of revenue.
Yeah, so there are three major points on that. One of them is Morris Dees had always been a political guy. He was a fundraiser. He made millions. But he also worked for the McGovern campaign. He raised a boatload for them, and he took their donor list for the SPLC. Another one is they got rid of the KKK and similar groups, and they needed someone else to keep fundraising from their fighting hate on. And the third is he was political and decided to merge those two things. He wanted to make money, and he wanted to attack people that he disagreed with.
And the people that he disagreed with, and we're going to take a brief break here momentarily, but the people that he disagreed with over time were not the, you know, white supremacists or haters of the KKK. He broadened the lens so as to be able to go after a whole variety of others who he would identify as haters and racists and bigots. And I'm sorry to say that I'm one of them that was so vilified by the SPLC in its more recent years. When we come back, Tyler O'Neill, I want to figure out what was the sort of political DNA of the SPLC from the beginning, and was it a natural progression, or was this a very cynical retooling for the purposes of making boatloads more money? We'll talk about that with the author of Making Hate Pay, The Corruption of the Southern Poverty Law Center, Tyler O'Neill, straight ahead.
Visit us at facebook.com/securefreedom with Frank Gaffney. You're listening to Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney from the nation's capital in Washington, D.C.
Welcome back. We are visiting for this full hour with Tyler O'Neill. He is a journalist with impressive credentials, but also the author of a brand new book entitled Making Hate Pay, The Corruption of the Southern Poverty Law Center. It's good to have you with us, and I really appreciate being able to tease out some of the things that I've always wanted to have somebody who's really studied the SPLC closely work through with me. Tyler, one of the things is Morris Dees began with the McGovern campaign, as you say. He got their mailing list, which immediately kickstarted his direct mail operation. He went after the KKK, among other relatively low-profile causes, but he made his chops on the KKK. What do we know about his politics and the importance of those politics from those early days forward?
He's always identified himself as very left-wing and said it's important for fundraising purposes to be radically left-wing or radically right-wing. So, you know, working with the McGovern campaign, and then he worked and fundraised for Jimmy Carter's campaign. He was not happy with Jimmy Carter on a whole host of issues. And there's actually this...
Not radical enough?
Exactly. Not even close. There's this story that former Carter aides told about Morris Dees going to the White House under false pretenses and just ratting out Jimmy Carter, because Morris had always wanted
to be... Going to the White House during the Carter years?
Exactly. Morris Dees had wanted to be Attorney General for George McGovern, and of course McGovern didn't make it. He fundraised for Jimmy Carter, and then there was some sort of falling out. Most of the people on Dees' team fundraising for Carter went on into the administration, but Dees himself did not. Actually, Dees' wife, then wife at the time, he's had five of them, went and worked in the Carter White House, and he went to go to the signing of the Camp David Accords. And he, but he was not happy with Carter. He had wanted to be Attorney General under George McGovern. He claims he didn't want to be Attorney General under Jimmy Carter. But from the way that he wrote his autobiography, from the way that he treated Carter in person in this White House meeting, it's clear that he held a grudge. And he went to Carter and ratted him out for, of all things, supporting the Hyde Amendment and not having direct government funding for abortion. Actually, one of the first groups that it looked like the SPLC was going to go after when the KKK started losing every case was pro-lifers. And he associated pro-lifers with terrorism. And even, you know, not to get too much off of a tangent,
go figure,
but there's a Supreme Court case called June Medical Services that
so
just got argued.
This is terrorists against the abortion providers.
Against abortion providers, right.
Okay.
So, like, there have been, and of course, horrible, there had been attacks, but there was this guy back in the 80s who published a book that said, I want to get the abortion industry shut down because I believe that, you know, abortion is killing babies, and he has the free speech right to say this. Morris Dees comes with the book after him with a lawsuit saying, you're engaged in illegal dealings against business. This is essentially like a pre-RICO case. And he tried to get him
shut down.
Yeah. And eventually Now took over the case, and it became known as Now v. Schneider, and it went until 2006. But it started in the 80s, and it started with Morris Dees, and then he dropped the case after 2 years. And it...
Having made a fair amount of money off of it? or did he drop it because he wasn't making enough money off of it?
I think he dropped it because it was going on too long.
Too long and not profitable enough. Interesting. So I asked this question, Tyler, because what Morris Dees and his associates did over time was, of course, to become much more radical in terms of their politics, specifically in terms of their aligning with the Muslim Brotherhood, for example. They were all in on attacks on people who the Council on American Islamic Relations and the Islamic Society of North America and others considered to be enemies of theirs. They portrayed them, of course, in my case specifically, as, you know, anti-Muslim. A meme that was amplified enormously by the SPLC with their hate lists and so on. But does this track, I mean, if you were to plot their trajectory in terms of their politics, is this a deviation or is this really just a continuity with respect to where they started and what they figured they could profit from doing as they pursued this political warfare agenda?
Well, it depends on who you ask. I tend to agree with you. I think that it's a deviation, but from the perspective of someone like Morris Dees, he probably would see it as a continuation. And they you know, on the left, they've started to think of Muslims as a persecuted minority who they have to protect.
Victims.
Exactly. And they can't square that with not only the diversity in Islam, but also the horrific history of abuses. And, I mean, not even history in some cases, the Islamic State.
Sharia itself, you know, is kind of a problem if you're worried about hate. Because there's a lot of it laced throughout that, of course. Not that all Muslims practice according to Sharia, let me hasten to add. But them that do are full on hate. And unfortunately, the people that the SPLC seem to be most comfortable working with are pretty much in the Sharia supremacist camp, as best I can tell. So, Tyler, when you look at the evolution of the SPLC, whether it's a deviation or it's a continuity, it clearly became the case that this became an instrument of political warfare over time.
Yes.
You know, vilifying those that they opposed and trying to silence them. No?
Yes, very much so. And I think I like to focus on 2010 and 2012, partially because that was the time that they decided they would start going after anti-LGBT, you know, self-described hate groups. And I believe that the Center for Security Policy, when did they first attack you guys? Was it 16 or earlier?
No, I think it was earlier than that, but it was probably in the between 12 and 14. I'd have to go double check, honestly, but it's been a long time, needless to say. And the troll is that, again, it isn't that there were grounds, I believe, for the kind of criticism that they were leveling at us incessantly, but it was all about trying to make sure that people wouldn't pay attention to what we were saying and would be deterred from, in fact, even working with folks like us. Which brings me to this larger point, Tyler, and that is, how does the Southern Poverty Law Center get away with having such incredible favorable treatment from the press when what it's doing so obviously is really censoring people and trying to ensure that they can exercise freedom of speech?
Yeah, no, that's an excellent question. And that's, I can provide an answer, but at the same time, it doesn't make logical sense. So part of it is the recent racism and sexism scandal last March that led to Morris Dees being fired, and then the allegations from former co-workers, or from those who worked at the SPLC, that they had been exaggerating hate and bilking donors, and that...
Well, I want to come back to that, because that's a whole other subject.
But yes.
But before all that...
But the media continues to treat them as if they're not a scandalous organization. And I think it's because they're a useful tool for a lot of left-leaning people
okay.
who...
That's the key point.
Exactly.
Before they had reason to believe that they were scandalous, they had reason to believe that they were wrong in what they were doing. And yet the press, the New York Times, Washington Post, lots of other mainstream publications would invariably cite the SPLC, and without any description of who they are or caveat as to, you know, their track record. Is this because basically they were so closely aligned in terms of their own political warfare purposes in these media outlets?
Yes, I think that's the main answer. The other one is many government agencies had, you know, shamefully relied on the SPLC. And that was partially because the SPLC cultivated a relationship, and they're still cultivating a relationship with some local law enforcement, but they're also cultivating it with schools by sending out their reports. So they send out these reports to hundreds of law enforcement, you know, local police agencies, and, you know, eventually people start realizing, oh, they're a source of information. The FBI has relied on them. The military has relied on them. And, you know, they've been called out, and this has been a back and forth. It's like, do we cite the SPLC or do we not? And there's disagreement in law enforcement on them. But when it comes to a lot of the legacy media that leans very hard to the left, the SPLC is a useful tool to silence views that they very much disagree with.
Right. I am living proof of the practice. Tyler, we're going to pause for a moment here. There's much to talk about in terms of the scandals of the SPLC and how they should finally discredit this operation. Also a lawsuit that they settled. We'll come to that momentarily. But when we come back from the break, I want specifically to have you talk about some of the damage they have done to people who they have vilified, particularly the Family Research Council. Our friends over there were very nearly murdered at the instigation, I believe, of the SPLC and its hate lists. We'll get to that and much more with Tyler O'Neill right after this.
Now more with Frank Gaffney.
Welcome back. We are visiting with Tyler O'Neill. He is the author of Making Hate Pay, The Corruption of the Southern Poverty Law Center. He is also a journalist at PJ Media these days and has contributed to the public policy debate handsomely over quite some time now through outlets like Christian Post, National Review, The Washington Free Beacon, among others. Tyler, we were talking a bit about the history of the SPLC, of course, both its early years and how it morphed into a political warfare instrument for the hard left with the help of the media that found very convenient this instrument for essentially suppressing speech or individuals that they did not fancy. I wanted to ask you about a specific example of an incident that occurred here in Washington, D.C., in which the silencing was not very nearly simply figurative. It would have been permanent and very literal. Tell us about the attack on the Family Research Council.
Yeah, so this happened in August of 2012. A man, you know, came into the Family Research Council armed with a semi-automatic pistol and a bag full of Chick-fil-A chicken sandwiches. And he later told the FBI his intent was to slaughter everyone in the building and smear a Chick-fil-A chicken sandwich in their faces. Thank God, you know, there was a brave security guard, Leo Johnson, who stood there and prevented the attack. He got shot
after
himself.
Being wounded. Yeah.
Exactly, in the tussle. And, you know, earlier today I spoke with General Jerry Boykin, and he was coming down, you know, this, you know, former Army Special Forces. He came down and he heard the gunshot. And even he was terrified. He knew what was going on. And as soon as he walked out of that elevator, he saw the police coming in. He saw Leo Johnson holding the man to the ground. But were it not for Leo Johnson and the police response, like, you could have had everyone in that building killed. Yeah. And he later told the FBI, the shooter, that he got the idea from the Southern Poverty Law Center's hate map. Mm. That's where he got the address. And he came with the intent of killing everyone. And this echoes comments that one of the SPLC's spokesmen, Mark Potok, made just a few years before this shooting. He said, our aim in life is to destroy these groups, to completely destroy them.
Yeah. Doesn't leave much to imagination, does it? And therefore, it's not hyperbolic to be pointing out that this is playing for keeps in terms of the political warfare that these guys have engaged in. Now, I'm not suggesting that they were endorsing the mass murder of the Family Research Council folks, and many of them are very close friends and colleagues of ours. But it is a predictable consequence when you brand people as haters and racists and bigots that some people may take it into their hands to try to punish you for engaging in such things, whatever the facts are. I mean, and the point of this story in part is the facts are not all that important to the Southern Poverty Law Center when they make these aspersions and slanders. And talk a little bit about, you mentioned this lawsuit that they were forced to settle on, in which they had gone after, of all things, a Muslim activist. Tell us about him and what, in the end, came of that suit.
Yeah, so they went after Majid Nawaz, and he was a former radical Islamic terrorist who had come out of that, seen the light, and decided he wanted to reform Islam from the inside. And he is one of the great voices for Muslim reform, along with Mzudi Jasser, who has endorsed my book. But Majid Nawaz was smeared as an anti-Muslim extremist, anti-Islamic extremist.
He was a bigot, wasn't he? Well,
yeah, yeah, right. He's horrible.
Islamophobe or something?
Oh, and guess what? The evidence that he's an Islamophobe or an anti-Muslim guy is that he went to a strip club for his bachelor party. Like, the Southern Poverty Law Center actually said that as one of their reasons in smearing him.
No kidding.
And so he filed
Telltale
a defamation lawsuit.
Of an Islamophobe, if ever there were one.
Exactly.
Wow. But the point is that when they settled this case, what did they have to cop to?
Well, they had to do a very embarrassing apology.
Public.
Oh, very public.
In multiple media, as I recall.
And, you know, one of the best things, the SPLC had this anti-field guide to anti-Muslim extremists. That had
I
to
believe
be
I'm
scraped.
Featured in it, as a matter of fact.
Yeah. Well, it had to be scraped from the internet as part of this lawsuit because
they'd gone after him.
Yeah.
But here's the point, Tyler, and in your research, I think you probably found evidence of this beyond this particular incident. But this is a case, literally a case, in which the Southern Poverty Law Center had to acknowledge publicly not only that its materials were unreliable, but that they caused harm. They caused $3.375 million worth of harm in this instance, as I recall. So has there been any perceptible change in how they are viewed, for example, by, you know, the New York Times or the Washington Post? And we're going to come back to this scandal in a moment, but just that would, it seem to me, be pretty much a conclusive basis upon which to say, wait a minute, we can't take these guys at their word.
You would think so. They're actually in court for many different lawsuits. In the book, I mentioned 10. Mm-hmm. And then, of course, you know, since the book's publication, there's been at least one more directly related and more lawsuits coming out of the woodwork. But the answer to your question is no. The New York Times and, you know, the Palm Beach Post and the Miami Herald just essentially copied and pasted claims from the SPLC and CARE in attacking ACT for America and the Center for Security Policy when it was revealed that they were having events at Mar-a-Lago. Mm-hmm. And, you know, Mar-a-Lago canceled ACT for America. And they didn't cancel
on this
you,
basis. No, fortunately.
Thankfully.
I think, and I do want to do a shout out here to Brigitte Gabrielle, who was very gracious once her own event had been canceled to make a point to the management of Mar-a-Lago that they mustn't cancel ours as well. And they didn't. And we had a very successful evening of it. But the point is that when you look at the record here, it is far from unimpeachable, shall we say. And that's before you actually get to what was revealed about the hatred and bigotry and misogyny and the like that has been apparently going on with Morris Dees, among others, in the leadership of the SPLC for years. Tell us about that story, if you would, Tyler O'Neill.
Yeah, so in the 1990s, so the SPLC is in Montgomery. The Montgomery Advertiser released a powerful expose series talking, you know, talking with black former employees who compared the SPLC to a plantation, talking about...
How long ago was that?
Yeah, that was the 1990s. That was 1991.
No kidding. Wow.
And
so people have been on notice for all these years. It wasn't
right?
just a recent turn of events.
But recently, you know, right before the big scandal broke, black employees had been saying the same thing on the Glassdoor employer review website. They said, look, black people have been working here sometimes for decades, not getting promoted within the organization. What is going on with this? This is a group focused on civil rights. And finally, the staff wrote a big letter. One of, I think she was like the number three or number four employee in the organization. I think it was Meredith Horton, wrote a letter to the entire staff saying, look, this is the history. This is unacceptable. Like, we need to get rid of Morris Dees at the very least. And I haven't seen this letter, but I've heard it reported elsewhere. And it worked. They fired Morris Dees. And by the way, as I talk about in the book, Morris Dees really got around. Like, there were women who were applying to work at the SPLC, women who were working at the SPLC. Even when he went to the signing of the accords with Carter, he didn't bring his wife. He brought a coworker at the SPLC who he'd been sleeping with, or, you know, so we think naturally.
So on top of the five wives, he was playing around with the staff. And this created, it seems, a bit of a crisis in the organization. It wasn't just Morris Dees who was essentially dismissed rather unceremoniously after all that he had done for the organization over the years. But several other senior leadership figures did as well. Tell us about them if you can, Tyler.
Yeah, the president, Richard Cohen, stepped down. The key legal director also stepped down. And then in the middle of it, there was the Michigan, I don't remember, a very prominent Democratic member of their board stepped off their board. And they claimed that she had removed herself from the board because she had just accepted a public office. But she was listed on the board until Monday, and then on Tuesday she was off, and it was clearly connected to the scandal. But then they acted as though nothing had happened. So this happened in March. By May, the SPLC was comparing itself to the Underground Railroad. And so it's like they automatically acted as if nothing happened, and the New York Times and the Washington Post and all sorts of major media outlets seem to have forgotten about it.
Gone along with it.
And it's been a year now, and we haven't heard anything from the internal review that was promised.
I'm surprised, I have to say. That is a topic to which we will return with Tyler O'Neill in our final segment, discussing a terrific book, Making Hate Pay, The Corruption of the Southern Poverty Law Center, right after this.
Go to securefreedomradio.org today. It's your freedom. It's your country. Frank Gaffney's Secure Freedom Radio. Go to securefreedomradio.org today. It's your freedom. It's your country. Frank Gaffney's Secure Freedom Radio.
We're back for the fourth and final installment of this remarkably revealing conversation about an organization that has done, to my way of thinking, incalculable harm for quite some time now. Perhaps early on in its life, some good work was done, perhaps even some in the mix even now, but it seems to me wildly overshadowed and more than offset by the material harm that they're doing, among other things, to efforts to expose enemies within, which unfortunately we do have in this country. Our guest is Tyler O'Neill. The book we've been discussing with him is Making Hate Pay, and it is about the corruption of the Southern Poverty Law Center, the SPLC. And Tyler, to that point, I mean, we've talked about, again, how this organization has morphed over time into a vicious political warfare instrument for the radical left, in the service, among others, of their Islamist allies. We call it the Red-Green Axis. But what's of particular concern is that they are shielding, it seems, some very dubious organizations. We've mentioned the Council on American Islamic Relations, one of the most aggressive of the Muslim Brotherhood fronts in this country. But talk a little bit about other outfits like Antifa and Students for Justice in Palestine, the prime movers behind the whole anti-Israel, anti-Semitic BDS movement, boycott, divestment, sanctions.
Yeah, there's a lot of harassment against Jewish students on college campuses, thanks to the efforts of, you know, thanks to the nefarious attacks of Students for Justice in Palestine and the hatred of Israel that they spew. And of course, Antifa carrying out violence in the streets, calling for violence against police. The Southern Poverty Law Center claims to be a monitor of hate, and they don't mention these groups. And then they work with, you know, the Council on American Islamic Relations, which was a co-conspirator in the Holy Land terror financing case.
Unindicted.
Right. Unindicted co-conspirator. Yeah. We gotta be clear. But they, you know, they had ties. They were originally ostensibly founded to protect Hamas, according to FBI and government sources.
Care, for sure.
Yeah.
It was Hamas, actually, and worked very hard to secure funding for them as well as provide sort of political interference for anybody who was going to attack them. It's a fascinating story as well.
Well, and they dismiss a lot of, I think it's interesting, they dismiss a lot of those claims, and they claim that this is wrongheaded. But the problem is they're still carrying water for, and this is one of the difficulties that the left has with Islam. They're still carrying water for Islamism and for Sharia supremacy. They're not, you know, they're standing up for the rights of Muslims, and Muslims, you know, have rights in the states. We very much believe in religious freedom for all minority groups. But we have to be careful because there is a threat of Islamism and Sharia supremacy that percolates through organizations like CARE, and
that has a political purpose. It's not about religion. It's about establishing ultimately a caliphate if they can. So you've indicated, Tyler, based on your research, that they've given a pass to a number of these groups, which effectively prevents them from being identified as one quite rightly could as haters and racists or bigots, at least. Talk about how the SPLC has parlayed its hate lists into an extraordinary position of influence in the social media platforms.
Yeah, so the SPLC is regarded as a trusted flagger by Google's YouTube platform.
That's a technical term, right?
Yes, it is a technical term. It means that the SPLC can go through and say, oh, that video is racism, that needs to be removed. That video is animus against LGBT people, that needs to be removed. And then
the platform does it.
Yes. And I believe, you know, they don't give the SPLC the final word, because you can always go to YouTube and say, look, there's a problem here, and they'll review it.
But that's usually triggered by them doing what the SPLC has recommended, which
exactly
is to say taking something down, and then you have to petition to get it put back up, if you're lucky. And the nature of these relationships is such that typically they will be so deeply in bed with the SPLC that you may well find you cannot get rehabilitated. This is a whole nother subject, but I know the SPLC has been influential with Wikipedia as well. And Wikipedia's become, in the course of particularly the past, I would say, 10 years or so, another instrument for political warfare. They're sort of joined at the hips with the SPLC. But when you look at the censorship role that the SPLC is playing now, is it again the case that it's generally applied to those on the right with whom the SPLC disagrees politically, and it's generally the case that the people on the left who might indeed be accused of engaging in promoting hatred and so on are getting a pass in the social media world as well?
Yes, in general. And you see this with the situation of Amazon, Amazon as a charity program, Amazon Smile. They cut off anybody on the SPLC's hate group list, but they'll gladly work with anybody else. And you see it outside of Silicon Valley as well. You know, Hyatt Hotels, Eventbrite, and, you know, a whole host of donor-advised funds have been pressured to cut off funding.
And banks, too. I mean, banks have actually been gone, you know, pressured, as you say, to stop providing services.
And MasterCard and Discover have done so. Yeah. They've cut off Robert Spencer with Jihad Watch. And this is a terrifying, like, if your credit card company, if your bank is not going to work with you because of your political views, because the SPLC says you're a hate group, is that an America that we want to live in? Mm. Like, this is further siloing us. And, you know, you have the people at the highest levels of government, you know, Democrats in the Senate, Democrats echoing the SPLC's talking points. So,
well, the Obama administration, before it left town, very definitely. So just to sort of tie this all up, Tyler O'Neill, we're talking about basically the instrument of political warfare going way beyond censorship, way beyond trying to stifle free speech. You're talking about actually doing material harm to people's businesses by, you know, demonetizing them or deplatforming them or otherwise making it impossible for them to do basic business functions. I presume that some of this is a source of the lawsuits that have been brought against the SPLC, and you say there may be 11 of them now. Needless to say, we wish them well in getting specifically to the bottom of what is this outfit up to and what has been the nature of the internal deliberation. Going back to what Mark Potok said about destroying their adversaries, this would seem to me to be pretty much evidence that they have been all about it. And finding documentation to that effect internal to their decision-making would be extraordinarily useful, I think, for all of us.
It would be. And there are a few lawsuits that have proceeded to the discovery process where there is a promise, a promising potential for that actually coming into effect. There was one guy who started a boxing club to help former addicts reform themselves. The SPLC said that his boxing club was a white supremacist group, and he was pushed out of town. He suffered real harm. He's filed a defamation lawsuit and made it into the discovery process. And then in Michigan, you know, you have David Yerushalmi and Robert Muse with the American Freedom Law Center have made it to the discovery process against Attorney General Dana Nessel,
right,
who has launched a hate crimes unit focused on SPLC accused hate
groups. Based on their documentation, right. So I'm not sure that they've gotten discovery against the SPLC just yet, but it sounds like it may be coming, and I certainly hope so, because nobody would make more hay with that information than Rob Muse and David Yerushalmi, two of our great friends and colleagues. Tyler O'Neill, we're out of time, I'm sorry to say. There's certainly more to talk about. I hope you'll come back to us again with regularity to keep us updated on these lawsuits, as well as, more generally, the work that you're doing at PJ Media. Come back to us again soon. I hope the rest of you will do the same tomorrow. Same time, same station. Until then, this is Frank Gaffney. Thanks for listening.
You've been listening to Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney.